It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, we got, as we do every week, lots to cover, and this week we're going to be doing the election coverage.
Yeah, we have a primary election coming up 2 weeks from Tuesday, but people got their mail-in ballots in the mail, or should have anyway, about the middle of this week. So we're going to do it a little bit early, and there's not that much on the primary ballot, actually, certainly not in the way of competitive races. So we're just going to try and run through them all this week. So get your pencil and paper ready, and if you don't have that handy, or you're driving down the highway, in which case, you know, taking notes is probably a bad idea. This also is all on the Eat the State website, which is www.eatthestate.org. And of course, you know, you could check the Seattle Weekly, except they don't do endorsements anymore, or news for that matter. But so it's somewhat of a disadvantage this year compared to last year's, because the Seattle Weekly editorial board, which I was on for many years, no longer exists, thanks to new management, and it won't exist in the future. And even if it would, I wouldn't be on it anymore. So I have not interviewed a lot of the candidates as I have in past years. I have met and talked with some, the usual caveats to not trust any one person's opinions, including mine, applies even more this year, because I'm operating from even more ignorance than usual. But here's what I think. There's only actually about 10 races on the ballot that where there are candidates opposing them, and of course this being a primary, some are Republican, some are Democratic, so you won't be voting for all of those 10, regardless of which you consider yourself, if either. A number of those are not competitive races, but we'll still run through them all, because in some of them where they're not competitive, you shouldn't vote for the incumbent anyway. And the best example of that is U.S. Senate on the Democrat side, where Maria Cantwell is running for re-election. We've talked a number of times on this program about some of the good things that she's done, particularly around the environment and confronting Enron and doing other things around energy policy. But she's got all kinds of reasons why anybody who considers themselves progressive or even a mainstream Democrat would be concerned that she's not representing the state, let alone her own party, very well. Her support of the war in Iraq, of course, not really sure where she stands on Iran, and that's kind of even more worrisome in some ways, since she won't be voting on Iraq again except for appropriations, but she could be voting on a war with Iran. Free trade, approval of judges, you can go down the list. There are four candidates opposing Maria this year. Unfortunately, only one of them is a credible candidate, and that is Hong Tran, who I've talked about on this program before. She's running an anti-war candidacy. She's very smart. She's got a very good background. She's really articulate, a lot of energy, a young Vietnamese immigrant, and she will make a great candidate in the future. She got a late start without any resources. She couldn't start until she had actually quit her job, because she worked for the federal government as a lawyer advocating for housing and other low-income clients. But hopefully she will run, and she has said she wants to do this. I've interviewed her a couple times, that she wants to run again in the future, hopefully for a lower-level office where she has a good chance of winning. But in the meantime, she is very good on just all of the issues that Maria Cantwell is bad on, and she deserves a vote just to demonstrate to Ms. Cantwell that there's a sizable constituency that's not happy with how she's been voting in D.C. So, Hong Tran for U.S. Senate on the Democratic side. On the Republican side, we learned even more this week that Mike! TM McGavick is, in the immortal words of David Goldstein of horsesass.org, a stinking drunk. and not only that, but wasn't even particularly forthcoming with his particularly forthcoming mea culpa that he issued a couple weeks ago, because as it turns out, he was even more drunk than we knew, because the breathalyzer test wasn't given until an hour and a half after he was pulled over. So he was probably, you know, like semi-conscious when he was driving the car. He was arrested rather than simply cited, and he went through a steady red light rather than a yellow, as he had claimed. But, I mean, there are a number of reasons to not like Mike. He's running a civility campaign based on the unspoken premise that Maria Cantwell has not been civil in the Senate, which, you know, there's really no evidence for. She's got a lot of faults, but that's not one of them. He then turns around and has attacked her with a misleading radio ad, and he's pretty much, he can't talk about the issues because he's right behind President Bush on all of them. He would be a disaster as a senator, although he'd be good on the cocktail party circuit, I'm sure. There are five other Republicans running against him, none of which are particularly good, some of which, like Brad Klippert, who is a fervently evangelical Christian former cop, are particularly bad. Probably the best of the lot, and also the person who is running highest in the polls. McGavick, in the latest survey USA poll, had only 66% of Republicans, and a full 19% were undecided. So there's still quite a bit of room to take a Republican ballot and make sure that McGavick doesn't get a huge majority in his win, because that might scare some money away from his campaign, along with his plummeting poll results after this latest flap. The person who is running second with 6% ran for the Senate in 2004 as a Democrat, so he's probably more moderate than others. His name is Warren Hanson, so I would suggest him on there if you're going to vote on the Republican side. Also for Congress, Jim McDermott up for re-election again in District 7 in Seattle, and he's got a couple of Democratic opponents. I only mentioned one of them on the ETS website because for some reason the voters pamphlet hadn't been out when I wrote it, and for some reason the King County Elections website only had one opponent, Joshua Smith, who's a staggeringly unqualified 26-year-old who really hasn't doesn't say anything in any of his campaign material or his website about why he would be qualified to run for Congress or what he would do if he got there. The other person who wasn't on there is Donovan Rivers, who, at least by his voters pamphlet material, is not particularly encouraging it either. Jim McDermott still needs the kind of challenge that he got in 2000 from Joe Swy of the Greens. He needs somebody who will call him on his BS of, you know, he's a very lazy congressman. He's been great on the Iraq war. He casts good votes. He occasionally remembers to do some good rhetoric on universal health care, which used to be his signature issue, but he's a very lazy congressperson. He takes a huge number of junkets. He does very little for the city of Seattle from his congressional seat. He's not in a position of leadership within the Democratic Party, which he should be given his seniority and the fact that he has such a safe seat. And, you know, all of those things improved in 2000 when a Republican came into the White House and he got a pretty spirited challenge from Joe Swy. He needs a credible candidate to run against him in a primary some year. But this isn't the year. So go ahead and vote for Jim in District 7. The most important races on the ballot by far are for the state Supreme Court. There's three positions up for grabs, and the Republicans are running extremely conservative candidates for what's supposed to be a nonpartisan post on all three. And this needs to be stopped, because if you have a Republican majority on the state Supreme Court, and we already are have a couple people in place, particularly Jim Johnson, Tim Eymann's former lawyer, who was elected a couple of years ago, then you've got problems. Going through them one by one, in position number one, you have Susan Owens, who's a pretty good justice, who's being challenged by a former Republican senator, a state senator. He's giving up that post. He's from Covington in order to run against Susan Owens. His name is Charles Johnson. There are three other candidates in this race, but it's really a race between Owens and including another one named Johnson. It's really a race between Owens and Charles Johnson. Vote for Susan Owens in that one. Position number, I think it's eight. Yes, it's position number eight, is probably the most important of the three, because John Groen, who is a property rights fanatic being bankrolled, and we've talked about this before in this show, the Building Industry Association of Washington, BIAW, which is the most powerful conservative business lobby in the state, abused the state campaign laws. There was a new law that came into place in June limiting the number of the amount of financial contributions you could make to a state Supreme Court race. Before that, it was unlimited. Now it's $1,400 maximum. So they went out and got business interests around the state to raise $10,000 and $25,000 at a drop of a hat checks for Groen's campaign. He's got four times the amount of money of Jerry Alexander, who's a 30-year state Supreme Court incumbent. Alexander's a pretty good justice, and he's being badly outspent by somebody who'd be a very, very bad justice. So he needs support desperately. Jerry Alexander in position number 8. And position number 9 would also be very, very important if the person the Republicans are running weren't such a nutcase. This is Jeanette Barrage, who people with a long memory may remember her name from the second half of the 90s up until 2000 when she was on Seattle Municipal Court. This is the woman who created a stir by insisting that women attorneys wear skirts in her courtroom. She is a property rights fanatic and an extremely conservative Christian in the Ellen Craswell mold. She was so incompetent that there came to be a backlog in the Seattle Municipal Court docket because so many lawyers would refuse to hear cases before her in the race that she finally lost for re-election in 2000. And you know she has to be bad if her behavior in a courtroom causes her to lose a race for re-election as a judge. The King County Bar Association actually rated her as unqualified, even though she'd been on the bench for 4 years. She tried to get a promotion in 2002 because she had been out of work for 2 years and needed a job to the district court. She lost that race. Now, you'd think she's in Bush's cabinet or something. She's trying for yet another promotion based on her incompetence to the state Supreme Court. She's running for position number 9 against another pretty good incumbent. That incumbent's name, which I am blanking on at the moment, is Tom Chambers. And so vote for Tom Chambers in 9. Do everything you can to keep Jeanette Barrage off the state Supreme Court because it would be a disaster. There are also some state contested races in primaries for state Senate representative in District 32, which is North Seattle. They're just playing games up there. The incumbent, who is Darlene Fairley, who is a fairly liberal state senator, she does not get along with one of the state representatives in that district, Marilyn Chase. The two are pretty much indistinguishable on the issues. They're both liberals. Marilyn Chase, a longtime peace and social justice activist, but personally, Darlene Fairley despises Marilyn Chase, and the 32nd District Democrats, the organization, is playing games with both of them, trying to get them, particularly Fairley, to stop bad-mouthing Chase. They fielded candidates of their own for all three of the representatives and senators in the primary, the other one being Ruth Hagee, another representative. The two representative races, the candidates withdrew after a week, but there's still a challenger to Darlene Fairley on the Democratic side in the Senate race. It's not a serious challenge. It's just, you know, fun and games amongst people who hate each other for no particular reason. So vote for the incumbent in that race, Darlene Fairley. In District 47 for the state Senate, that's Covington. That's the seat that Charles Johnson has given up to run for the state Supreme Court. On the Democratic side, there are two people running. Claudia Hoffman, who's a longtime Native American rights activist, is the more liberal of the two, also by far more qualified. Vote for her. And the other race, which probably everyone in Seattle is kind of aware of, is District 43. Ed Murray is trying to and almost certainly will move over to the state Senate. There are no fewer than 6 candidates vying to replace him, several of whom have very good progressive credentials. The 6 are, and let's see if I can do this from memory, Lynn Dodson, Dick Kelly, Stephanie Purer, Jamie Peterson, Bill Sherman, and Jim Street. Running through those, Lynn Dodson, a teacher at Seattle Central Community College, former head of, I think it was the State Jobs with Justice, longtime peace and social justice activist, Dick Kelly, who has very good credentials, particularly around things like housing issues as an activist. Stephanie Pure, who is a legislative aide to Peter Steinbrück on the city council. She's young. She's energetic. She's done a lot lot of good things. For example, she was the one who shepherded charter member number 3 onto the November ballot. She's also very good. Those are the three best of the lot. Among the others, Bill Sherman, an environmentalist, very good on those issues, but he's also, and he shows up regularly drinking liberally. He's a nice guy. Unfortunately, he's also been endorsed by Mark Sidran, Jim Drago, and Pat Davis, and you really can't find a more reactionary threesome in the local Democratic circuit, so that worries me about him. Jim Street, also a progressive. He used to be on city council a number of years ago. He has been a judge since then, but he's very much of the political insider old boy network in Seattle, and we don't really need another one of those in a very safe Democratic seat for state legislature in Olympia, because what we've learned is that those people do nothing once they get in. They treat it as a lifetime sinecure. And then there's Jamie Peterson, who is by far the best funded of the six candidates. Primarily, he's getting his money from the business community. He's the most conservative of the six running, but he's also a gay man running for the seat that Ed Murray and before him Cal Anderson have held pretty much as the seat from which most gay advocacy has originated in Olympia for the last 20 years. But Peterson would not make a very good state representative. He's just not very, not very dynamic and not very progressive on a lot of different issues. So of the three, there's no shame certainly in voting for either Stephanie Puhrer or Dick Kelly, but I'm going to give the nod to Lynn Dodson. I think she's the most qualified. She's very well known in the local activist community, and I think she'd get a lot done in Olympia. She's very good at working with a lot of different types of people. I think Stephanie Puhrer has a great future ahead of her. She would be good in Olympia also, but I don't think this is the right time or race for her, and same for Dick Kelly. So that's District 43. That's probably the toughest of any of them. The one uncontested, there's also a slew. All of the other various Senate representative races in Seattle have Democrats that are running unopposed for re-election. And just on general principle, I don't believe in endorsing people who are running unopposed. We, shouldn't be living in a country where elections resemble those in the Soviet Union or North Korea, but unfortunately many times we do. The one exception is Norm Mailing, who's running as for King County prosecuting attorney for his 6,438th term, and because he is, and because he shouldn't have been in office this long already, and he's also the only Republican office holder in the city of Seattle. I think we need to write in Gary Ridgway to replace him. And I think that's about it. There is one other race. It's for district court for the Northeast Electoral District, judge position 2. There are 3 people running here, 2 of whom are existing judges, and I'm going to endorse the 3rd. The 2 existing judges are a guy named Frank LaSaleta, who has been a judge up in San Juan County and actually got reprimanded 3 years ago for cozying up to a San Juan County prosecuting attorney in determining the sentence for somebody convicted of running a meth lab. We don't really need more people conspiring with the prosecutors sitting behind the bench. We also have, what was her name? Mary Ann Ottinger, a sitting judge, a King County District Court judge. In fact, I think she's the incumbent in this race. She's also run into a number of problems and been, in fact, she was suspended from the bench for 30 days without pay this summer for improper procedures in the courtroom. The 3rd guy running is Richard Pope, who is something of a perennial candidate. He's also pretty knowledgeable. He's kind of a maverick Republican, but I think he's the best qualified for this race. So Richard Pope, Northeast District of King County District Court. And that's it for the ballot for September 17th.
All right.
So we did it in 1 week.
All right, moving along, but related to that, looks like the initiative relating to the Sonics is going to be on the ballot.
Yes, I-91, which is being shepherded through by Citizens for More Important Things, the resurrected group of Chris Van Dyke, has qualified I-91 for the ballot, so we will get to vote in November, essentially on whether to send the Sonics to Oklahoma City, which is probably going to happen anyway. But the measure would demand that if the city of Seattle makes any deals with the Sonics, that it has to be a deal that turns a profit for the City, which would essentially stop a $200 million subsidy dead in its tracks. Of course, with the new ownership, they've said that they're willing to pay for a portion of a new arena, but they've also said that the arena they want will cost $400 million. So it's still very much of a concern, and they've said they want to stay in Seattle. Take that for what it's worth, but there's certainly still an effort underway locally to try and get the public to pay for some of a very expensive sports arena. This would stop it, and it will be on the it will be on the ballot in November.
All right. And Ricky Clausing?
Yeah, Sergeant Ricky Clausing, who turned himself in a day after announcing that after having been AWOL for over a year, he showed up at the Veterans for Peace Convention in Seattle a few weeks ago, announced he was turning himself in at Fort Lewis, did so. He had left from his post at Fort Bragg after having served a tour of duty in Iran as an Army interrogator. He was charged this week with desertion, and there was another GI resistor that turned himself in this week at Fort Hood in Texas. Sergeant Mark Wilkerson went AWOL 19 months ago, and he's now sitting in Fort Hood, also waiting to be charged.
All right. I don't think we're going to have time for national. Let's jump to international.
Okay.
We can move back. Iraq.
Yeah. Speaking of GI resistance, a lot more people died in Iraq this week. Meanwhile, the U.S. military has put out bids for a two-year, $20 million contract looking for a PR firm to look to improve the U.S. military's image in Iraq. Maybe if they stopped shooting civilians more or less randomly, torturing people in prisons, and raping civilians, that might help their image. A PR firm could probably take that and run with it. Also, we had a report this week from the Independent newspaper in Britain. Once again, you have to go to Britain, get good reporting on what's going on in the U.S. and places where the U.S. is active, that 10,000 Iraqi civilians are confirmed as having died in the last 4 months. It's and I saw elsewhere a figure of a rate of 40,000 a year, which would actually put it at something like 13,000 over the last 4 months. But it's probably extracted from more recent months as the rate has gone up. A lot of civilians are continuing to die in Iraq. The U.S. is trying to put the best possible spin on it, and we heard, of course, from Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld this week at the American Legion Convention, Rumsfeld berating people who two-thirds of America who has doubts about this war, basically as being morally I don't even remember his terms, but it's pretty insulting. And then Condoleezza Rice trying to put perfume on a skunk and claim that the war on terror has been a resounding success. It hasn't been, of course, and more and more civilians are dying, and maybe that so there's another report this week that one of the reasons they're dying in such numbers is that Sunnis who are victimized by the sectarian violence are refusing to go to hospitals anymore because Shiite death squads are going to hospitals, dragging Sunnis out of their wards and executing them. The death squads are targeting the hospitals, and the health ministry of the Iraqi government that we're bankrolling is being controlled by the Shiite militias. That's what's going on in Iraq. There was a bunch of stuff around Israel and Lebanon this week and Gaza Strip. Kofi Annan announcing on Tuesday, the head of the UN, that Israel has violated the ceasefire that has been in place 70 times since the ceasefire took hold in mid-August. Hezbollah only 4 times. Israel said in response that there is no ceasefire. What there is a cessation of hostilities, which makes you wonder whether Israel is trying to renew the hostilities, particularly because they are still blockading Lebanon by air, land, and sea, something that isn't being reported, particularly in the U.S. The head of the humanitarian division of the U.N. also reported this week that 90% of the cluster bombs, we talked last week about cluster bombs having been dropped all over southern Lebanon, that they're made in the U.S. and that they target primarily civilians. Well, 90% of those cluster bombs were dropped in the last 72 hours of the conflict before the ceasefire, namely when Israel knew that it was about to end. Moreover, there was another report that 70% of those cluster bombs have not exploded. That in fact there are up to 100,000 unexploded bomblets all over southern Lebanon. We've had 13 people killed so far in Lebanon, and many more injured since the ceasefire by bombs continuing to explode there. The reason that the number of unexploded munitions are so high probably is because they were old stock. Israel would have known that. And you combine those two things, and there's an unavoidable conclusion that nobody in U.S. media that I'm aware of has stated, which is that Israel intentionally dropped bombs that would not immediately explode all over southern Lebanon just before the ceasefire. That, and with a type of bomb that primarily targets civilians. What that means basically is that Israel was trying to keep civilians from returning to southern Lebanon, and they were doing it by continuing to target Lebanese civilians long after the ceasefire, which again is a war crime to intentionally target civilians, particularly when a war is not supposed to be happening. This is the type of behavior that has led a Lebanese government that, remember, was the great democratic hope of the Bush administration in January 2005. The prime minister, Fouad Samoura, said this week that Lebanon will be the last Arab company to sign any kind of a peace treaty with Israel. And of course, that government's on its way out anyway, because the next election, Hezbollah will win. I guarantee it. They are very popular in Lebanon right now and across the Middle East for having stood up to Israel. And finally, while this has been going on with Lebanon, don't forget that Israel is still continuing to bomb and shoot at and besiege the Gaza Strip. Again, something not being reported in U.S. media. And there was a U.N. report this week that 70% of the 1.4 million people in Gaza are now without food. It's an immense humanitarian crisis, and again, it's not being reported here, and the U.S. has been, as I've mentioned in past weeks, actively posing an obstacle to international humanitarian organizations that are trying to get food and medicine and other supplies into those civilians.
All right, and very briefly, Mexico.
Yeah, the Electoral Tribunal in Mexico gave the conservative candidate, Felipe Calderon, slightly narrower but still a victory based on its 9% partial recount. López Obrador, the liberal candidate, is still insisting on a full recount, still defiant, still saying that he and his supporters will shut the country down if the Electoral Tribune issues its final decision on behalf of Calderon, and that decision is due by next Wednesday, September 6th.
And Venezuela.
Venezuela report, again in the British press, The Guardian this week, that the U.S. aid is giving $25 million to Anonymous, that is in public disclosures, FOIA requests, it's being redacted. Anonymous groups working for quote-unquote democracy, that is to say they're anti-Chavez groups in Venezuela, and this in the lead-up to the December elections, and a lot of people in Venezuela are saying once again that the Bush administration is trying to drive Chavez out of office.
And very quickly, events.
A lot of them coming up this week. I'll be in D.C. this week, by the way, all week at Camp Democracy, which is going on from the 5th through the 20th. Look it up. It's a fabulous event. I'll talk about that when I get back next week. Here in Seattle on Monday, there will be a big Labor Day march for human rights and economic justice. Gather and march. Goodness, I didn't even write down the time. I think it's an afternoon, but you can look up on the web. It's at Norman and 23rd South. The rally will be at MLK Jr. Park, 2200 MLK Way. On Wednesday, as you heard at 7:30, South Korean and U.S. negotiators will be in Seattle this week trying to work on a free trade agreement. Big protest on Wednesday, 12:30 at Westlake Park, and there will be a march to the convention center. On Thursday evening, David Corton, the excellent and local economic analyst from over on the other side of the sound, and I think in Bainbridge or Kitsap, he lives somewhere over there. Anyway, he will be in town at Seattle First Baptist Church, speaking free of charge. It's 1111 Harvard Avenue. It's Thursday night at 7 p.m. Saturday, next week, but you have to get your tickets in advance, limited tickets at the door, so I'm mentioning it now. There will be an Arab American Community Coalition fundraising concert for humanitarian relief for Lebanon. That'll be at Town Hall. Doors open at 6:30. It's $35 general seating, $70 reserved seating. You can order online or at 1-800-838-1006. And Saturday and Sunday next week, the Arctic Communities Northwest Conference at Bastyr over in Kenmore.
Right, talking with Job Parrish as we do every week, co-editor at Eat the State. And quickly, where do people find Eat the State?
You have those election endorsements once again in the current issue. You can find it at places where you get free publications around the city, or you can find it online, www.eatthestate.org. And if you have comments, feedback, tips, you want to volunteer, or you just in general want to, offer slurs and anonymous, hate threats, which we get from time to time, you can leave it on our voicemail. Our number is area code 206-719-6947.